Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. This is episode 93, at the very beginning of September. Host is Marty Jones, produced and edited by Owen Woods. And our guest today is Connor Bourne, the Stewardship Coordinator for the Rio Grande Headwaters Restoration Project. The Outdoor Citizen Podcast is sponsored by the Colorado Housing and Financing Authority and the Lohr Foundation. Welcome, Connor, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for having me.
Let's first get into your background a little bit. Tell us a little bit about where you came from and what your professional background is like.
Yeah, definitely. So I am born and raised in Central Kansas. I'm in Newton, which is just north of Wichita, about 25 miles or so. Grew up around, you know, not only corn and soybean fields, but also the few chunks of tall grass and mixed tall and short grass prairie that exist on that landscape. And that definitely colored, you know, as I interacted with both those things and then just, you know, finding bugs under rocks as a kid in my backyard. Ended up going into the sciences in college, among other things.
Did you go to Bethel?
Yes, Bethel okay. College. It's a small liberal arts college. Thankfully, I was able to do a lot of different things at that college, being a liberal arts college. Definitely focused in on science, because as I sort of got deeper and deeper into those fields, the questions that came up became increasingly more interesting and worthy of sort of focusing on, whereas other things like music or other, you know, subjects were interesting enough and became hobbies, but didn't necessarily get to be a profession.
Right. But I should mention that this is not going to be a major topic of the discussion.
Right.
But don't sell yourself short on the music. Connor is an outstanding trumpet player, plays with the SLV big band, with the community band, just a really fine musician.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I definitely enjoy being able to keep up playing music here in the Valley in several different forms. I, you know, played music all through middle school, high school, college, and it's always been something I've been really invested in.
So how did you come to Alamosa from Newton?
Good question. Yeah, so I found a volunteer position through Mennonite Voluntary Service, which is a really small church-owned program run through the Mennonite Church USA, and it has several different volunteer opportunities in Alamosa, and one of them particularly caught my interest because it seemed like it touched on some of those same science points that I was interested in: restoration, ecology, conservation, as well as just being an opportunity to serve a community. I think that's one of the values that was instilled in me a lot growing up, and then again at college, is that in any way, if you can find a way that your work gives back to your community or benefits your community in some way, that is something I find a lot of value in. And coming for specifically a volunteer position checked that box of serving a community, but also I wasn't really ready to enter the workforce and, you know, have to worry about paying bills and all of that stuff. And that's kind of a nice soft launch, if you will.
Yeah. And we are certainly glad that you are here. Your volunteer opportunity was with the Headwaters Restoration Project?
Yes, it was. So I did 2 years as a volunteer. And then after those 2 years was up, I was fortunate that they offered me a position. And based on the projects I was already interested in and working on, I could kind of almost piece together my position as it were, to sort of make it fit with what I was really interested in the project.
Write your own job description.
Yeah. Yeah. In some ways.
Yeah. Excellent. So including your 2 years as a volunteer, how long have you been with the Rio Grande Headwaters Restoration Project?
So I started in 2019. So 7 years. Yep. This summer will be 7 years.
Excellent. And can you describe your role with the Headwaters Restoration Project?
Yeah. So it's as stewardship coordinator. I mean, title isn't incredibly descriptive here, but a large part of what I do is monitoring both before and after restoration projects to see if we're sort of meeting the mark, if we're actually making beneficial changes for the projects that we're doing. And I'm also working a lot up in the headwater systems doing stewardship projects, a lot of which are with the Rio Grande National Forest. More recently, that has meant a lot of process-based restoration, which we can get into a little bit more here in a minute, I'm sure, and some beaver management, we'll say, in several different forms.
Now, I believe that our producer and editor has accompanied you on at least one of the beaver relocation projects. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. He was fortunate enough. We were fortunate enough to have him, I should say. I think 2 years ago now, during a particularly rainy season stretch of weather in September, or was that August? And we took about 5 beavers up to the Trujillo Meadows, up above Trujillo Meadows Reservoir, down on the Rio de los Pinos.
And where did those beavers come from, the ones that you relocated?
Those were from a nuisance situation up a creek, a tributary of the Rio Grande, up near between Del Norte and South Fork.
Okay. And have you been able to go back above Trujillo Meadows and check out to see how the relocated beaver are doing?
Yes, we were up there this year, and they are doing work in some capacity. They have been finding a place to settle long term. They actually had settled immediately at sort of the mouth of the reservoir as the river empties into the reservoir and created a bank den there. And then this summer, with the weather that we've been having, as the reservoir levels dropped, they've been moving upstream and actually building off of some of the beaver dam analogs that we had made several seasons ago.
So this is kind of a nice transition to talking about beaver here in Alamosa.
Mm, yes.
So beavers are generally more nocturnal, so people who go out for walks during the daytime don't often see them. But we do have beaver here in Alamosa, don't we?
We do, yes. And not always right through the main, levee section here in town by Cole Park, but oftentimes on the outside, both upstream and downstream, there's quite a few signs of beaver activity. And I should correct myself. There's been beavers before in the Farm Park Lagoon, if you're familiar with that sort of off-channel habitat. They've been there quite a few years.
Hmm. So there's a beaver dam on the Rio Grande in the riparian park right now.
Yes.
Why?
Impressive.
Yeah, it is pretty impressive. This is the first time I've seen a beaver dam all across the Rio Grande through the city limits of Alamosa anyway. Why do you think the beavers are creating a dam there? And what allowed them to do that?
Right. So I'll start with the first question.
Why did they build it there? Where they have it?
So I actually, Alamosa Riparian Park is a restoration site that
you guys have done a lot of work there. Yeah.
That I believe was completed back in 2022. It had several instances of construction. So they were all kind of spaced out in that section. But as I was back this summer for monitoring, which is part of my job description, going back and seeing what are the bank conditions like, how's the riparian vegetation doing, I noted that there were bank beavers very close to the site. And what some people might not be aware of is not all beavers need to build dams. Beavers, when they live in a large enough river that has deep enough water, their habitat requirements are fulfilled. It's only when they need to create a deep enough pool to feel safe from predators or to access certain food sources, that's when they make those dams and create those pools. So the bank beavers were existing before the dam. And once water levels dropped low enough, then their instincts were triggered and saying, oh, well, our den is in danger here of being exposed to certain predators, or we just don't feel safe, but we want to stay in this location. And they took the materials from the surrounding riverbanks and decided to build themselves a dam. And it's only because of that, yeah, those low flow conditions that they were able to do that.
This is the first time I've seen a beaver dam across the Rio Grande. And I've lived here 37 years.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a sad commentary on the level of the river through the city.
Yeah, definitely. It's both cool to see, but also a sign that something is not normal. So yeah, that the conditions that are existing are definitely out of sync of where they usually are.
So what kind of other projects do you have coming up in the next, let's say, couple of years? Because I'm sure you're planning ahead well in advance of just 6 months.
Definitely. So the projects that I personally am looking forward to involve some more low-tech restoration, process-based restoration, and that often involves beaver mimicry. So making beaver dams in the river, often in smaller streams. We're not going to be damming up the Rio Grande at all like these beavers, but up in the headwaters, creating these small structures that can slow water down and catch sediment. That sort of work is going to be paired with continuing beaver relocation, like what Owen and I had the opportunity to do. And there's also going to be an opportunity to expand and have sort of a new program, which is offering more coexistence and management solutions for folks in the valley. So a lot of times irrigators, water rights owners, farmers, they are at odds with beaver. That's why we trap them out and relocate them oftentimes, because they can clog up head gates, they can clog up flumes, and it really just mucks up the works of a lot of our water delivery system. But a lot of folks around the country have been pioneering ways to protect these infrastructure pieces, whether it be a head gate or by using a combination of fencing and other things to deceive the beaver. You know, in fact, one person coined the term beaver deceiver, and it has really spread like wildfire. And he insists it's only one specific type of thing that is a beaver deceiver.
Well, yeah, it's the one that he has developed.
Yes, exactly.
Not close analogs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I particularly like the term, and I tend to use it a lot when I'm talking to folks that have been battling beavers, because it, to them, it really is this perpetual issue where they feel like if they can one up, if they can find a way to outsmart the beaver and maintain things while the beaver is left helpless, then, I mean, that's essentially what we're hoping to do, is help these people out, maintain their infrastructure, and then hopefully not have to worry about as much trapping or relocation or other things.
Keep the beaver happy and in place, but also satisfy the needs and desires of the water users as well.
Yes, I think that's the ideal situation. Obviously, there are some situations where beavers are just never going to be a part of, you know, there's some cases where a beaver is building a dam in a ditch, and there's really not much you can do. And in that case, we want to try to have relocation available. But at the same time, folks are always going to manage beaver in the ways they want to manage beaver, and we're not looking to really get in the way of that.
Although, do people contact the Headwaters Restoration Project about relocation, translocation of beavers?
Yeah, increasingly, yes. And that's something, you know, with the capacity we currently have, it's something we don't want to, you know, freely advertise as this thing we're ready to jump in and help you. A lot of the choke points involve the sort of the limiting factor is having a reliable trapper and having places that we can prepare for and have them release, knowing that they aren't going to do anything harmful in the release location. And all of that stuff involves a lot of collaboration with Colorado Parks and Wildlife.
So, Connor, as a part of the translocation, do you have to do a lot of scouting to find appropriate places to let the beavers go?
We do some of that, definitely, yeah. And part of it involves some initial mapping and modeling. We've done several maps of the Rio Grande National Forest that involve the beaver relocation assessment tool. The BRAT model or tool is something that somebody has developed for use nationwide. I believe it was developed for the Intermountain West, and then different drainages have used it. There's also a great map. Maybe Owen can pull it up here real quick. But yeah, what that has really done is used mapping and identified places where there is both current or semi, you know, relatively current beaver activity or active beaver ponds, and then where there's no activity and potential for beaver, where there has been beaver in the past potentially. But a lot of it has been local knowledge as well, hearing from folks that, hey, you know, there used to be beaver up here and they've been gone for 5 years and we're just not sure where they went. And we go up and scout that location out and determine, oh, are the environmental factors still there that would allow them to exist if they were brought back?
The Colorado Beaver Activity Mapper.
Yes. Beaver Activity Mapper. And Sarah Marshall, I believe, was one of the major and not... I'll call her out because I think she's doing a lot of good work in that space.
Yeah. Very good. So have you noticed in the years that you've been here increased or decreased beaver activity?
That's a good question. I think it really gets into the question of, are there more or less beavers than there were when I first got here? I would say it's fairly similar.
Okay.
If anything, it's very place specific. My running theory is, you know, a lot of beaver activity seems to be that is no longer occupied up in these small headwater streams. Drought seems to be a factor that we have several dry years. Beavers decide, oh, I don't want to be up in this, you know, it doesn't quite have the water supply for me. And then they either move downstream or they are predated. And the process of getting them back up in those systems is much slower. All that to say, I think there is a capacity for beaver if we were to sort of look at our management around water, specifically high order streams in these headwater systems where there's a lot of evidence of a lot of historic beaver activity. And all of the research is showing us that these are really a keystone species. that used to be very, very influential on the habitat. I would hope that as beavers to continue to be sort of a hot topic in sort of nature circles and especially here in the Intermountain West, that we would see an increase.
So does there seem to be some natural translocation? Do the beavers migrate? And if so, what kind of distances do they migrate?
That's a good question. Yeah, so they do naturally migrate. A beaver colony only really at ever at any one point ever has three generations. So you have the sort of main parents or grandparents, I guess, in some cases. They will have a litter, and then that litter will stick with them for 2 years. And at that, the next year after when the last year's kits are a year old, the next kits will be born. They'll be raised by both of those generations before that middle generation splits off and finds their own mate and then starts their own colony. And they generally will only move as far as they need to find suitable habitat. So that could mean only a mile, only half a mile up or downstream. In some cases, that could mean 5 or 10 miles, or, you know, there's some extreme instances of beavers moving quite a ways in order to find suitable habitat or to find a mate.
Does that include going to different basins?
Pretty much never. That there's a few instances of beavers, you know, trying to climb over hills, climb over into different drainages, but that is a very risky thing to do. That's something that they would rather not do unless they are really, in their minds, given no other option.
And what you were talking about beaver predation earlier. What kinds of critters will take on a beaver and try to eat it?
Pretty much anything. I think this might have been a line from somebody that Ben Goldfarb interviewed in his book, Eager. Beavers are basically, when they're on land, basically like walking chicken nuggets. Everything wants to eat them, and they are not hard to eat. They have very little defense, which is why they build these dams with the deep water. So this could mean coyotes, wolves, mountain lions, bears, bobcats even. It's a very opportunistic thing that if a beaver's caught out on land by a predator, it is really not given a whole lot of options other than going back to the water.
Right. You know, Connor, the outfit you work for is named the Rio Grande Headwaters Restoration Project, but your projects are not limited exclusively to the Rio Grande. Tell us some of the other streams that you've been working on.
So we've also been doing work on the Canoas, which of course does meet back with the Rio Grande, but is considered a separate system in the valley. And then also Sawatch Creek, we have a project in the works there as well. A lot of the work we've done on both of those systems to start is looking at irrigation infrastructure and looking at specifically old and outdated irrigation infrastructure that is both non-functional to the water user, but also not benefiting river health very much. And we're learning so much in the last, you know, few decades about how to build structures in the river with minimal impact that, you know, back 50, there are some structures that are pushing 70 years old that weren't really built with the idea of, you know, moving sediment and having minimal impact on fish and things like that. And it's a really good opportunity to both help out a water right and help out agriculture and things like that in the valley while also providing a health benefit to the river. And like I said, we've had two phases of work on the Caneos that has been doing a lot of that work, adding fish passage and more functional diversion structures for different ditches. And we also have one up in the works on Swatch that'll be, I think it started out at 5 and now maybe we're at either 7 or 9. The number of ditches that want to work with us is kind of continually growing, and
oh, good.
We need to figure out where to kind of say, okay, we'll do one phase and then maybe do another phase, you know.
Right, right. So there's no lack of work available.
No, not right now. You know, obviously the question is, as a restoration project, is the goal to put yourself out of work? I would say in some ways, yes, but that is a very lofty, almost unattainable goal, given our current situation. And talking about restoration as being different in different contexts. So the restoration that I do up in the headwaters is often geared towards restoring to a state before a disturbance has happened that has caused the system to kind of unravel or reach a state that is no longer able to recover itself and go through the normal cycle of sort of the disturbance regime, really, that habitats need to go through naturally. That's possible up on the forest, but down on the valley, you have a very managed system that has a flow regime that's very altered, and the restoration that we can do here down on the valley is much different and involves, you know, restoring these infrastructure pieces to something that can exist without fully sort of putting the river out of whack, or creating habitat for fish, or revegetating stream banks and stabilizing them so that, these very highly variable flows don't put excess sediment in the river. And all to say that, you know, I think both things will continue to be very relevant, but I'm encouraged by the fact that we're starting to understand that there's always compromise that can be had in restoration, and we need to understand both the human values that exist and the potential of the sort of natural ecosystem values that we could have.
Part of your office duty involves being outdoors, right?
Yes.
But what do you enjoy for outdoor recreation?
I enjoy several things. I have been rock climbing for a few years, so I very much enjoy Penitente and Promised Land, and I've been meaning to make it out to some other areas up in the San Luis Hills there. I believe that's a good area for climbing. I've been trying to take up mountain biking, but not willing to pull the trigger on buying a whole nice mountain bike. Thankfully enough, I was able to take the Alamosa Bicycle Coalition Build a Bike program and got a mountain bike working that way, and have been riding around the Rio Inspire and things like that. But to be honest, the amount I get out for work, especially here during the field season, often scratches that itch for me. You know, a lot of the times I can camp out for work out at a restoration site, that I'm very fortunate to have that ability.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with Connor Bourne, stewardship coordinator for the Rio Grande Headwaters Restoration Project. Connor, in case people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Yeah, so our organization's sort of main contact email is info@riograndeheadwaters.org. And that's a great place to get in contact with anybody from our team. We've got a office of three folks and one remote person, and soon to be four, which is exciting. We've got a growing group of people that are all really interested in being open and talking about our projects to the community. Yeah.
Okay. And is there anything, before we wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to mention that we haven't touched upon?
Yeah, I'll say a lot of this work that I've been talking about with both process-based restoration and beaver relocation could not have been possible without my partners at the Rio Grande National Forest, specifically the Fisheries Department in Rosalie Reese and Jason Remshart. They really were the other half of the collaboration that began this work, and we continue to work really closely to this day. CPW partners have also been really collaborative, and that's one of the success stories of this area, is we sort of figured out how to work with CPW and make relocation possible within the regulatory framework.
The San Luis Valley in general is known as a good place to build partnerships and a lot of common ground, which is what I really like.
Yes, I agree completely. It's a perfect storm of partners that came into the success of this project, in the sense that the organization comes from this grassroots background of irrigators and water managers. And through those connections, we're able to build trust with folks like the Division of Water Resources and CPW and the Rio Grande National Forest. And therefore, we're able to sort of take in all of these different perspectives and figure out what kinds of projects really have the best benefit for both the habitat and our community.
Super. Well, we've been speaking with Connor Bourne, the stewardship coordinator for the Rio Grande Headwaters Restoration Project, talking about a variety of things involving restoration. We'll be right back after we take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. You're listening to the Outdoor Citizen.
Support comes from Colorado Housing and Finance Authority. CHFA supports Colorado home ownership and works with a statewide network of lenders. Visit chfainfo.com/your home. CHFA is an equal housing lender.
Looking for the freshest food in the valley? Introducing the new SLB Local Foods Directory, where you can meet your neighbors and eat better. From colorful potatoes and crisp greens to farm-fresh eggs, dairy, and meat, find exactly who grows your food right here in the valley. Support local, eat fresh, and strengthen our community. Are you a local farmer or producer? Add your information. Visit elmasacitizen.com today and discover the freshest food from the heart of the valley.
Welcome back to the Outdoor Citizen. Here are some outdoor conditions for you. We hope you've been enjoying the occasional rainfall that's provided a bit of relief to the August heat. With August now in the rearview mirror, here's a look at the hottest August we've ever encountered here in the great San Luis Valley, the high mountain desert region of Colorado. August saw 13 days of 90 degrees or warmer temperatures, 25 days of above normal temperatures. 93 degrees Fahrenheit was the monthly high temperature. Precipitation was a whopping 0.18 inches, second only to the 0.10 inches of precipitation registered in 2021. August had an average daytime high of 87.3 degrees, warmest ever for the month of August. And the harsh reality is the last time August produced meaningful rain was 2022, when 3.8 inches of rain fell. And I'll tell you, Owen, I know that you've been feeling the heat just like I've been feeling the heat. it's no surprise that this is the hottest August on record.
No, no. And with some of the pressure systems that are moving, we could be in for a pretty gnarly September too.
I saw a forecast that a heat dome was going to be present for at least a good portion of early September.
Yeah, and a lot of the heat dome is moving kind of over the central Mississippi Valley, and so central U.S. is going to be high humid, high heat for most of September.
At least we don't have the high humidity that is associated with the rest of the Midwest. Yeah, Here's some news from the out of doors. We'll start with some election news and a couple of ballot proposals Coloradans will be voting on this November. And my understanding is that the ballot this November is a pretty thick one.
Yeah, this is
lots of issues.
Lots of really controversial issues, lots of constitutional amendments. This is going to be a pretty big election year just for if you want to just focus on the initiatives and on the stuff that's going to be on the ballot next to the candidates.
Right. So one of these is a ballot initiative securing a, quote, right to hunt, unquote, in the state. And another is a ballot proposal that would direct already collected sales tax on goods like tents and backpacks for use by Great Outdoors Colorado and its programs, wildfire mitigation, and outdoor recreation. Let's begin with Initiative 302. It's being promoted as a, quote, right to hunt, unquote, constitutional amendment. The initiative aims to enshrine the right to hunt and fish in Colorado, quote, by use of traditional methods, end quote. Opposition to the initiative is coming from Colorado Hunters and Anglers for Sensible Wildlife Conservation. The group says the measure solves no demonstrated threat to hunting and fishing in Colorado. Initiative 302 is backed by Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management and the Wisconsin-based International Order of T. Roosevelt, which, according to a report from Colorado Newsline, has successfully led similar campaigns in other states and seeks to preserve the so-called, quote, North American model of wildlife conservation, end quote. That model is based on the beliefs that wildlife should be for the non-commercial use of citizens and should be managed in a way to sustain its population. In opposition, Charles Seymour from Colorado Hunters and Anglers for Sensible Wildlife Conservation says, quote, hunting and fishing are already legal in Colorado. State law recognizes hunting, trapping, and fishing as primary methods of necessary wildlife harvest. But once this vague policy language enters the Constitution, it will lead to endless litigation as some hunters try to reverse reasonable limits supported by a majority of Coloradans that have been established to achieve important wildlife conservation and management goals, end quote. Signatures have already been approved to put Proposition 137 on the November 3rd midterm ballot. Previously called Proposition 308, the new ballot measure could divert $175 million to $180 million a year in already collected sales tax on sporting goods equipment toward conservation, wildfire mitigation, watershed restoration, and improved outdoor recreation opportunities. Our friend Jason Blevins at the Colorado Sun writes that Proposition 137 would distribute $83 million to $85.6 million a year to Great Outdoors Colorado, nearly doubling its annual revenue from the Colorado Lottery. More than $83 million a year would go toward wildfire risk mitigation and watershed protection, with funds evenly split between the Colorado Department of Natural Resources and the Colorado State Forest Service. The state currently spends about $16.4 million a year toward wildfire reduction work and $5 million a year towards rehabilitating burned landscapes above rivers and streams. An 85-year-old cyclist was killed after being struck by an SUV on Highway 119 outside Boulder last Monday, August 21st. The initial investigation from Colorado State Patrol showed that the cyclist was riding southbound on the right shoulder of Highway 119. As he attempted to turn left onto 83rd Street, the cyclist made three lane changes, moving from the right shoulder into the far left lane of the highway. A 33-year-old woman who was traveling southbound in the left lane on Highway 119 and struck the cyclist as he crossed in front of her vehicle, according to the Colorado State Patrol. The driver is said to be cooperating with law enforcement. This is the second cycling death this year on Highway 119, known locally as the Diagonal Highway. And I know we mentioned this on the last Outdoor Citizen podcast, but this would be a good time to remind all drivers that with schools, both elementary and secondary and college, in session now, there's going to be an increase in pedestrian traffic, scooter traffic, bicycle traffic, so and automobile traffic as well. So let's everybody pay a special attention while we're driving. Put down those phones. It's illegal to have a handheld device right now anyway. But put down your phones. Pay attention to the highway, the streets. And let's not have any repeat of what happened in Boulder here in Alamosa.
And for cyclists, you got to be vigilant too, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the big thing is we're vulnerable on the road. And if you can be a little offensive and defensive, I think you can prevent a lot of bad stuff.
And let's remember to signal our turns.
Yep. Yeah. This case has highlighted a clear legal distinction that a lot of people don't know is that in the eyes of the law, if you're on a bike, you're treated as a motorist. You are treated like you're driving a vehicle, and that means proper lane changes, following the law.
Right.
It'll save your life.
A burst pipe in Pueblo released more than 4.25 million gallons of raw untreated sewage into the Arkansas River last Thursday, August 27th. That sewage has since made its way into the John Martin Reservoir in eastern Colorado, prompting Colorado Parks and Wildlife to issue a "don't touch the water" warning. The reservoir tends to see a sharp increase in boaters and recreators over the Labor Day weekend, but has been experiencing higher levels of toxic algae and other toxic bacteria throughout most of the summer. Part of that is due to the fact that it's a very low water year here in Colorado, so that gives more opportunity for the water to warm up and increase the bacterial and algal growth. CPW officials said in a release, quote, beginning August 31st, visitors should avoid swimming, wading, tubing, paddleboarding, fishing, and other activities involving direct water contact. Visitors should also keep pets away from affected water. Warning signs will be posted at the park and around the reservoir to alert visitors to the contamination and water contact advisory, end quote. The public is advised to also avoid the Arkansas River and the area around John Martin Reservoir. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment is monitoring the water, and the Colorado Department of Agriculture has alerted downstream communities and ranches of the potential contamination. The Bureau of Land Management is opening 14,095 acres for oil and gas development near Aurora Reservoir beginning on September 8th. The oil and gas lease sale will offer 29 oil and gas parcels, totaling that 14,095 acres in Colorado. The BLM completed scoping on these parcels in April of 26, held a public comment period that closed in June. A 30-day public protest period closed on August 7th. Leasing is the first step in the process to develop federal oil and gas resources. Before development operations can begin, an operator must submit an application for a permit to drill detailing development plans. The agency said it reviews applications for permits to drill, posts them for public review, conducts an environmental analysis, and coordinates with state partners and stakeholders. Meanwhile, outside Colorado, a federal court hearing to halt construction of border infrastructure in Big Bend National Park and across the Big Bend region of West Texas is scheduled for Thursday, September 3rd, in El Paso, Texas. U.S. District Judge Kathleen Cardone will hear testimony and review evidence on a request for a preliminary injunction to halt the construction started in August by the Trump administration. The request for an injunction was filed by the Center for Biological Diversity, Friends of Ruidosa Church, and a Big Bend landowner. Bulldozers started tearing into Big Bend National Park near the iconic Santa Elena Canyon in early August, but was paused until after this hearing.
Real quick, one of the things that they're doing is incorporating man camps along the construction area. So they're basically moving people in, moving construction workers and contractors in a semi-permanent basis. And so there's always a constant presence of people there, and they're referred to as man camps. This is a tried and true method that has been used for controversial development for a long time.
And even if the construction is on pause, population in the man camps has not diminished.
Yep, exactly.
Two people are dead and one person is still missing after torrential rains and flash floods struck Grand Canyon National Park. The area of Bright Angel Canyon was essentially washed away by a flood of water and debris. Entire campsites were washed away, bridges collapsed, and roads washed out. Nearly 100 people were evacuated from the bottom of the canyon over the weekend. And if you haven't seen the photos, that was a reasonably impressive flood. Not as impressive as what we're getting to next. And that's the flash flood in Nepal, on the Nepal-China border. The death toll from that flash flood, triggered by glacial melting, has now surpassed more than 1,000 people. More than 4,000 people are still missing or are unaccounted for. Search and rescue officials from Nepal, China, and Tibet have been working day and night conducting search and rescue and, unfortunately, search and recovery missions in the midst of more potential flooding. Yeah, leaks are building up, and there's a real concern that because of all the rain that's going to continue to fall, these floods are going to breach the temporary dams that were created. Described as being like cement, the debris field that washed down the river valley has covered entire communities in thick layers of rocks and sediment. Some communities have been completely destroyed. On the Chinese-Nepal border, the wall of water that destroyed border crossing buildings struck at more than 105 miles an hour, with a wall of water that was more than 300 feet high. It was incredible seeing the video of that.
Yeah, I mean, unlike anything I've ever seen, and you talk to geologists and people who've been studying that area, nobody's ever seen anything like it.
Yeah, incredible. Workers in a series of hydrologic tunnels have been trapped since the flood. Time is running out as the survivors are running low on food and water. The initial report was that an earthquake had caused a 900-meter piece of a glacier to snap off and create a cascade down the river valley. But scientists believe now that rising temperatures caused by climate change in the Himalayas caused the underlying structure of the glacier to melt over time and snap off. The section of glacier that broke off then registered as a 5.2 magnitude quake. The towns and communities affected by the flood are more than 55 kilometers downriver from the glacier. Now, some outdoor events that would look good on your calendar. The 6th Annual True Penitence Climbing Festival starts October 2nd, goes until October 4th. Located in Penitente Canyon, the 3-day climbing fest draws climbers from all over the country to take part in great sport climbing in a unique crag. We'll have more details on the climbing festival in the next episode. But for now, you can sign up to compete or volunteer at www.slvclimb.org. Coming up this weekend is the Creed Mountain Run. Runners will have the option to run a 2, a 12, a 22-mile, or a 50-kilometer course. Sounds like just what you need, Owen. Sounds like just what I need. Really destroy my knees with that. The race begins within the town of Creed, leading racers along Main Street early in the morning. As sleepy stores open and coffee shop patrons step onto the street to cheer racers on. The course follows Willow Creek out of town and up towards the Black Pitch, testing their endurance for a quick altitude gain while piquing their interest with old mines hanging precariously from vertical cliffs. The 12-milers round out the Bachelor Loop, while the 22-milers climb up to the top of the Continental Divide before making their return into Creed and the finish line. The 50K race branches off for a gorgeous stretch of single track at the head of Miners Creek, then down the mountain to return to town. Also coming up this weekend, if you're not inclined to do the 50-kilometer Creed Mountain Run, the 5th annual South Fork Alder Ass Race is also this weekend. And that's not a nasty word. That is a donkey, the biblical name for a donkey, right? Packborough Race, it begins at 10 a.m. at South Fork's Brown Memorial Park. On Saturday, August 12th, the Tater Trot 5K Walk and Run will kick off the annual San Luis Valley Potato Festival. The 5K starts at 8:30 a.m. in Monte Vista's Chapman Park. You can sign up to run through the link in the outdoor report. And the entire event is out of doors, so it counts as part of Outdoor Citizen. Mm-hmm. And there's always really cool stuff. There's bands, there's celebrity chefs, or chefs anyway.
Yeah, learning how to
all sorts of interesting potato dishes, some that you may not have ever encountered before. That brings us to the end of this episode of the Outdoor Citizen podcast. This episode of the Outdoor Citizen was produced and edited by Owen Woods. The Outdoor Citizen is published by AlamosaCitizen.com. You can listen to the show wherever you stream your podcasts. If you have an outdoor adventure you'd like to share, or if there are topics you'd like to hear about in a future episode, please send an email to info@AlamosaCitizen.com or Owen@AlamosaCitizen.com. As always, we want to give thanks to our friends Don Richman for his song Sea Turtle and Daniel Boyce for getting out there and recording the sounds of the valley's birds. I want to give a special thanks to all the listeners who have been doing rain dances. You could start doing snow dances anytime now. And, you know, I really appreciate getting the cooler temperatures during the day. Hopefully, we're not going to creep back up into the 90s during September, but it's anybody's guess. So, as always, thanks for listening. Go enjoy these great temperatures that we're having right now. Get outside and have some fun. Thanks for listening.